Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you walk over the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I see you've got a black cat there. It looks just like my cat.
Oh, you have a black cat?
Yeah, we got two.
Interesting. Because I was thinking about talking about my cat today just because I had a cat experience this morning, which was that he was on my lap, and once he's on my lap, you know, I feel like there's an authority there or something. Like I shouldn't move him. It just feels almost like an act of violence to move him from my lap. So I just stayed there for about half an hour breathing, and I had a really good time, and I thought, well, I should do this more often. I should let my cat dictate my activities.
Yeah, I do that a lot because it's always a good idea. I mean, often a good idea to just stop and do nothing for a little bit.
Yeah, really hard. Crazily hard to do that. So I was catching up on your wiki page. I had looked at it before, but I hadn't looked at it in detail. So I guess we'll just start there. Obviously, start with you and what you are and who and what you do. So I first heard about you because I was looking for an agent, which I do from time to time. I've pretty much given up. Like, as you probably know, if you looked into my stuff, I've been published a whole bunch of times and never managed to get an agent. So I pretty much gave up. But then my wife thought it was a good idea, so she was kind of, she was doing the research and finding different agents.
Uh-huh.
So I found you. That was how I found you. And then I looked into other stuff that you're doing, and I was really surprised by that, because I've always thought of agents as, you know, men in grey suits that I wouldn't really want to know, but as kind of necessary evil. And then when I discovered the stuff you're doing, I was like, oh my god, I gotta have him. He's like the dream agent. It's like somebody like me. And so that was my introduction to you anyway, was like an agent, an anomaly among agents.
I got into agenting because, I have written quite a bunch. And when I was in college, I wrote a lot of novels. I wrote 7 novels. And at 2 different times, I had agents who had, to some degree or other, signed me up. But I was a really bad client because I didn't want to revise any of my work. I was hell-bent on writing more, and I just thought if I just kept writing more, that I'd just get better and better. And the next idea that I had was always better than the idea I had. And then, so none of these agents would want to work with me, naturally, because I wasn't really interested in revisiting my work and making it publishable. But then finally, I just, you know, ended up with just this box full of novels that were pretty unpublishable. But then when, after 9/11, I was working at a theater in Manhattan, and I decided to quit because I figured this was probably, you know, apocalyptic end time type thing. Mm-hmm. So I might as well do what I, and go back maybe and finally rewrite and revise one of those novels. And I did, and went to look for an agent. And I met a couple, with this friend of a friend particularly, who sort of convinced me upon meeting them that it was something that I could probably do, and it seemed fun. So I sent resumes out to a bunch of agencies, and nothing happened. And I went to call them back to follow up, and everybody who had received my resume didn't want to see me, but the one whose address had changed, so she didn't get my resume, she said, "Well, why don't you drop by?" And then she ended up firing me. Because I think the resume that I sent out scared them off.
Right. Yeah. So you can identify then a little bit with my plight. Not that I've described it, but essentially, yeah, I just feel like I give out a sort of the kind of vibe that is off-putting to the world of commerce.
Mm-hmm. The world of commerce is I think, inimical to art. And one of the difficult things, the sort of impasse that I've come to as an agent, is that I'm really convinced that the entire world of publishing, well, at least the six major companies, are more or less completely controlled. I think one thing I noticed early on was that they were all, the major publishers were all owned by privately held Western European publishing companies.
Mm-hmm.
Privately held means, of course, that they, you know, they can't be publicly audited. Western European, of course, means that they're companies that were probably heavily subsidized by the CIA throughout the entire second half of the 20th century.
Right.
And I wouldn't like consider it outrageous to imagine that a company like Bertelsmann, a privately held West German publisher, isn't more or less owned by the CIA. And when you think about the amount of money the CIA put into influencing hearts and minds in Western Europe from 1945 on.
Yeah. So, well, that's a very whole interesting area right off the bat. So let's linger on that at least for a little bit. How do you think that kind of level of control works? Because, I mean, I've actually been published once by a semi-major publisher, which was Orion. They published Matrix Warrior. They're owned by some French company that build missiles. So, I mean, we're definitely seeing high-level corporate power there. So I felt like I slipped through the net there in some way. The book wasn't promoted, it didn't sell, and so on and so forth, so it didn't have any major impact. But still, it seemed like it got through the net. So how do you think that kind of control works? Like, if the CIA owns a publishing company, presumably they're not micromanaging.
Well, I think a lot of the editors, you know, at least some of the editors, are probably witting agents. But I think most of them aren't. But I don't think they need to be, because it's really, there's a really powerful sense of, amongst the ambitious literati of which way the wind is blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really more of setting an overall tone or agenda. And the younger, ambitious agents who know, editors who know how to get ahead, they just sense which way the wind is going and they go with it. And the ones who are real troublemakers, actually, I would say just, through the generation of editors that I've seen get hired and which ones stick around, a lot of the brightest ones I felt like have left. And some very bright ones have stayed. But I think, you know, the ones that are more outside the box thinkers are gone. And I think that's in general, the way I think corporations work is that that people who think outside of the box who are sort of counter-cyclic in a way, that they just get eliminated.
Right. And not literally.
Yeah. Well, some of them, I think, got out of there so fast and sort of were eliminated with prejudice. But I do think with the agents that I've seen out there also, that there was a generation that I saw sort of end of really outrageous characters, flamboyant dressers, and with very intelligent and independent minded that I saw sort of get out of the business, and that it's more corporate now, like in terms of it's always been a kind of a cottage industry, but it's gotten to be less so. There's more of the work is being done by those companies like ACM, ICM, and Author's House, the sort of bigger agencies.
Right.
And the smaller agencies are a little bit more marginal. And the business as a whole, I think one thing that I think would shock people to realize is that literary fiction in the United States, for example, there's a single person who can put the kibosh on a book. You know, everything goes through there's a single control node for literary acquisitions in the United States, and that's this woman named Cecily Hensley.
What?
She's the buyer for Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I've had a book up at editorial board at like six different houses.
Yeah.
And then they'll all call me within a few minutes and tell me no. And that's because Cecily Hensley put her thumbs down, and she's by no means a sort of nefarious character like you might imagine. I don't know her, but she's the kind of person, she just loves things like water for chocolate,
mm-hmm.
Or water for elephants, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
just cozy mystery type housewife stuff, and the way it's funny, like the way that this. That the control pushes literature is really towards a sort of very bourgeois suburban sensibility. A lot of sort of kind of tame realism.
Mm-hmm.
Stories about affluent people who have affairs in the suburbs and things like that. I guess kind of domestic realism.
Right. So there's a sort of housewife sensibility there, then.
Yeah, that they push towards.
Just on a minor point or detail, how is this woman, how could she have the time to screen every single submission?
Well, in terms of the six major houses,
mm-hmm.
that sell, probably over 95% of the books that are sold, that's all we're talking about. And so all the thousands and thousands of literary novels that are published, probably the greater number of titles are put out by the smaller companies that might sell 300 copies each or less.
Right.
So the number that she's looking at, and she doesn't read them all, she probably just reads the catalog copy.
Mm-hmm.
For most of them.
Right. So would you, as a writer, would you even aspire to have a mainstream publisher, or would you actually prefer not to at this point?
Well, if I were to... one thing that's interesting is it's really changed my idea of what being a writer means. Because I think people in the United States, at least, they get a sense... I've run into a lot of people who have the sense that they'd like to be a writer. And to me, that's a really interesting idea because it seems to be independent of what needs to be written.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, I think of it more in a sense of the message. You know, if there's something that needs to be said, I think fiction writing is in. I'd say the larger category of fiction writing is a sort of aid to a fugue state. And, when you talk about genre fiction, romance, mystery, or anything like that, it's basically what it is it's an aid to allow people to enter into a fugue state.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say it was a way of wasting time for the bourgeoisie. you know, that basically you go into this comfortable dream. It's a narcotic.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that is completely mixed up in people's minds with another thing that literature does, which is it's a kind of ethical experimentation. Like when you talk about the novels of Tolstoy, that basically what this is it's philosophy of ethics, and experiments are being done in a virtual space to try to understand ethical issues. And then there's a third thing that's done, which is more like a sort of epistemological novel, which you see with a lot of experimental fiction, where they play with narrative more like phenomenological, epistemological issues of philosophy. And that's a very unpopular type of novel. I guess Gertrude Stein and her successors,
mm-hmm.
Well, even maybe Don Quixote. And that's a really small fraction of literature. But most of the books that are published and consumed are the first category. It's just an aid to entering into a fugue state.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when people think about when most people think about they'd like to be a writer, they're sort of confusing those three categories. Or what's done in nonfiction, I think, is in terms of important writing or an important book, it's do you have something to say? Do you have something important to say? Is there something you've researched and come to understand and that you need to share to the world with the world for the world's benefit? That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to just continually like pursue this occupation of putting words in a row for whatever reason, you know, because you feel like you're good at putting words in a row or something like that.
Right. Well, we've gone very deep, very fast there, and because we've got right to the core of my dilemma as a writer, and no, it's not a lifestyle choice. It is a struggle. Like, one of the things I say, which is kind of a bit of a simplifier, but it becomes my own trope, but that I'm writing to try and figure out why I'm unable to stop writing. But the positive side of that is that I mean, the more I explore writing through writing is that I'm trying, and you talk about the fugue state, I'm trying to discover something that I don't know about myself through writing, discover the truth of myself through writing. And I think that when you talk about the fugue state, it's very interesting because it's a bit like the hypnagogic state. It's a bit like between dream and waking, this liminal space, where you're between your own identity, your own sort of fixed sense of who you are, and in the case of reading fiction, you're entering into somebody else's creation. But also the act of writing has this effect. It doesn't have to be fiction writing, but whatever, you're entering into a fugue state where your own identity is maybe becoming less solid and less fixed. Maybe even as I write, I'm kind of taking apart my identity by writing about it. So the potential there is twofold. One is that if people in a fugue state are open to being programmed, you know, they're open to receiving new ideas, propaganda, let's say, most simply put. So entertainment's never just entertainment, right? People are getting what they want, which is to forget their lives for a second, but they're opening up to this other program which is coming through corporations and even what's behind the corporations, let's say. But the positive side seems to me that a fugue state, if a writer's really doing it conscientiously, is the possibility of actually discovering some deeper truth that's hidden beneath the identity, and letting that signal come up. And that's what I'm exploring with writing now. Well, I've always have been, but more consciously now, is there a way to become a messenger for myself, and using writing to deliver the message to myself? And then the question, well, whether this is something for the world at large, I mean, that's kind of what was behind my question to you, because I still do want to have the big publisher and the bestseller, and not just because I want to be able to pay my mortgage, but because I want to reach more people. But I'm really divided about that because of what we're talking about at the very start, of just how compromised the whole thing, even to the point that I don't trust writers who are successful now. I mean, I find more and more evidence that writers who have been successful were affiliated with intelligence, like Anthony Burgess was supposedly put messages from MI5 into Clockwork Orange. Castaneda seemingly had ties to intelligence, and so on and so forth. So it does make me wonder if maybe that would be a sign of failure, you know, if I was able to actually do something that was acceptable to to the world. Maybe that would actually be, maybe that's the opposite of what I want.
That's a lot of really interesting points. And one thing that I wanted to respond to was you were talking about your reasons for writing and the different things that writing can do. And I think that's a kind of writing that I didn't enumerate in my little list. But basically, I think that type of writing that we were talking about there can vary at one end from being therapy, that kind of self-therapy or self-discovery, to the other end, what I might call prophecy, you know, or different kinds of channeling, not necessarily of Ishtar command, but of different, you know, because I think we all share a mind, you know. I think we're sort of time sharing on one large mind. And that reality as we know it is inside out in terms of how it's commonly perceived, or is how we bandy about in language in a naive fashion what we think the world is. I think it's inside out of that. The mind is on the inside, and this body is sort of a little incrustation on the outside. And that when we this kind of channeling can be everything from, you know, we're accessing different voices inside our head. And those are like different sort of different stations, different areas of reality that we can bring through, and that we can practice bringing through. Like if we cultivate a certain writer's voice, something like that. There's a lot that can be done there, and I think this range ranges from the sort of channeled writing where we have people tuning into voices that tell us things about reality, to the way that people do philosophy, where they which is a kind of writing where they think about things in a certain rigorous way, and then they're able to write down the results of that thought process, to things like revelations, where they're actually just receiving a text from some sort of entity that they think of as being somehow separate from themselves but connected to them. There are all these different kinds of writings. There's sort of like Gertrude Steinian language experiments, where she tries to set aside, I mean, maybe even in a sense go deeper into language by putting aside conventional grammar and ideas of making sense.
Oh, she did that as well? Because I haven't read Steiner, and I've never read Joyce, but I've been reading about Joyce recently because McLuhan was so into him, and so I've ended up reading clips of Joyce and remembering why I've never read Joyce and why I never feel I would ever want to read Joyce, and yet I'm fascinated by what he was trying to do and apparently why he was doing it.
Well, I got really into Gertrude Stein for a couple of years, but basically just this one work, Tender Buttons, and we did a theatrical interpretation of it. And so to do that, I did all kinds of research on her, and it's very interesting because I think she's very close to sort of an inner circle of the culture, this kind of control circle, and was very close to the sort of advent of avant-garde art, of the 20th century in Paris. You know, she was she brought the world Picasso, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And quite a few other artists were brought to the public through her salon. And these kinds of things are experiments in consciousness, you know, sort of bringing different ways of thinking to humanity. And I'm sure, I mean, you can't say she didn't have a lot of support from different kinds of what we call the establishment. I mean, she was a pet student of William James at Harvard.
Right.
And she was studying his, you know, varieties of religious experience. And they studied all these kinds of ideas of automatic writing and channeling in Harvard, you know, in spiritualism back in the late 19th century. And she claimed to have no unconscious. Or there was some experiment that William James, that their class did, and she had no unconscious response. And so she was sort of this strange experimental subject, but then she went really heavy into this kind of writing where she would basically meditate and write down these phrases that came to her. And that was this book, Tender Buttons, which is a really radical linguistic experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I ended up working on that book for like 4 years. And I was convinced that one of the things that it was about and one of the reasons for the language being so cryptic was it was a way of talking about her childhood sexual abuse, you know, and that of her family at the hands of her father and her uncles, which, you know, you weren't allowed to talk about. She wasn't allowed to talk about, and people still aren't allowed to talk about. But through creating this kind of subverted language, which nobody could understand, it gives her a freedom to talk freely. You know, and I think that comes through in a lot of, like, William S. Burroughs' writing or in James's writing, that when you have, Joyce's writing, when you have all these things, or Henry James' writing, when you have all these things that cannot be spoken about, then people evolve ways of writing about them, which are hard to understand. I mean, that's why you have work like James Joyce writing so incomprehensibly, I think, is because there are things you cannot talk about.
But you think that was relating to things that socially it was not safe to talk about, as in the case of Stein, or more that things that couldn't be expressed through language, and so language had to be kind of transformed through the expression?
Probably both. But I hadn't read much Joyce, so I can't speak to it.
Right.
But I do know, I mean, there's all this stuff that's been coming out lately about how they find mass graves outside of, you know, Catholic orphanages in Ireland, and the way that Ireland has been used as a sort of traumatized population by the British elite, sort of captive, traumatized population for various types of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't have... I mean, you certainly get that sense in Becker of him being a highly traumatized individual who's trying to express just how unspeakable the things are that he's not saying, that are left unsaid.
Right. Well, it seems that there could be an overlap there between the inner and the outer. Like, I don't feel that there's anything that I'm not willing to write about because of social constraints. I mean, I try to be strategic and sensible about it, but generally, in particular, and the climate we're in now, I mean, pretty much anything can be talked about in a sense. But on the other hand, There are things that are kept secret from myself, and this relates to trauma and fragmentation, the whole MK Ultra thing, which, was turned into this dark science, but it seems like it's been going on for millennia, and is just part of the natural defense strategies of the psyche, the way that it will fragment and create these pain barriers for overwhelming trauma, and that creates amnesia and compartmentalization of the psyche. So when you're talking about using writing to find different voices, that's what I've been exploring recently. And I've stayed away from fiction. Well, not exactly stayed away, but I've just never been able to do fiction. And for me, it's a real, there's been a wall there that I've had to break through or climb over to actually even really start writing fiction. And one of the things I'm discovering is that by finding different voices for myself, it's like letting different aspects of my psyche speak that have been fragmented and compartmentalized and that actually don't have communication between them. And so I'm keeping secrets from myself, so just as the government is keeping secrets from its people and the church and whatever other conspiracy cover-up crimes we want to look into that do usually relate to trauma or abuse of power. And so it's as within, so without kind of dynamic there.
A little call anything show shutters. Come here and see what prints all day. A whole few watermelon. There is no poke, no cutting panties, and little dressing, and shoes, white soles, and little spats. Really little spices, a little lace makes boils. This is not true. Gracious of gracious, and a stamp of blue green wide bow. Blue green lean on the top. If it is absurd, then it is leadish, and you're set in where there is a tight head. A peaceful life to arise for moon and moon and moon. A letter, cold sleeve, a blanket, a shaven house, and nearly the best and regular window. Near and Pharisee, near and farther, show white has lime in sight. Show a stitch and ten, count morsel that thicker and thicker is leaning. I hope she has her cow. Bidding, wedding, widening, receiving, treading. Little he mentioned nothing.
You know, I think it's true what you said, that there's, nothing that we can't talk about today in certain circles. But say if I for instance, I took out a book proposal recently that was written by a woman who appears on television sometimes. She's got a PhD. She was a human rights expert for the UN, a highly credentialed woman who was writing about child porn epidemic at the Pentagon. You know, have you heard about this, where there's like 5,000 computers were found at the Pentagon with child porn on them?
No.
And she goes through and she just meticulously documents child abuse by local police departments, by governmental figures, by like Child Protective Services departments in the United States, a real bombshell of a proposal.
Mm.
Woman can write, you know, and everybody turned it down.
Right.
Because you can't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, you personally could talk about it. You could write about it on your blog,
mm-hmm.
and there probably wouldn't be anybody come and shoot you or anything like that. But they're not going to publish that. And if you say, for example, if you wanted to be a well-published author in the public domain,
mm-hmm.
There are certain subjects that you can't talk about. Like,
yeah.
In terms of what a Random House or Macmillan is going to publish, they're not going to publish 9/11 Truth. They're not going to publish anything about MK Ultra. They're not going to publish anything about, have you read Dave McGowan's stuff about serial killers?
Programmed to Kill, yeah.
Yeah, they wouldn't publish anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole, you know? And so
it doesn't even get reviewed, actually.
Yeah, you could say that that we can talk about all this stuff now, but only within certain circles.
Yeah.
Only within certain ghettos.
Yeah, and it's not just what you're talking about now. Like, if you've talked about it in the past, then Random House or whoever won't want to pick up what you're presently doing. I would imagine, even if it has nothing to do with what you are known to have spoken about in the past. So, I mean, I've been having this dilemma with the podcast because I want to keep it my own thing and to talk about the things I want to talk about and talk to people who want to talk about the stuff that you're not supposed to talk about. That's the whole point of it. But I also want to talk to people who have more of a reach, more of an influence, and are more known, not just because they are, but because there are some people who interest me who happen to be more, you know, well-known and well-positioned. But that creates a problem for me. Like, recently I talked to Anne Diamond about Lennon Cohen and MKUltra, and then sort of congruent with that, I started looking into ritual abuse in Hampstead, so I posted my blog about it. And I definitely got a sense, and it may have just been imagination, but that my emails weren't getting answered, and I started to kind of worry. I'm not going to be able to get the people on the podcast that I want, because now I've crossed this line, right? If they have agents, the agents will just look at the website, oh no, he's talking about MKUltra, you don't want to talk to this guy. That kind of thing, where if you're seen to be going into areas you're not supposed to be, then you yourself become dangerous by association.
Mm-hmm. It's something you said earlier that I found interesting. You were talking about how if you see that somebody's a successful author, sometimes it makes you wonder if they're not compromised. And, you know, you think about, like, Frances Stoner Saunders, her book, The Cultural Cold War, where she talked about how, the abstract expressionists were promoted by the CIA. And then you see just how much... You go into that and you see how much, or the Partisan Review and authors like Susan Sontag, who was probably in some way compromised by interaction with the state in that way as a sort of covert propagandist. Mm-hmm. And you see just how deeply and how far back, you know, this kind of influence goes. And then, you know, also from where I sit, you know, I read submissions from a lot of great writers who you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the best writers in America today are unpublished.
Wow.
Or very, very marginally published. And I think that may, I don't know, that may have always been the case, or maybe it's especially the case now. But it gives you sort of a perspective maybe on what golden ages are, you know, and you think about like a golden age of writing or something like that is maybe just a time when the best voices are heard for a brief while, you know, and it's not so much that there's a flowering of the arts, but that the state is not preventing the most vibrant voices from being heard. So I think what's going on in America now is that the best voices are not being heard. And to a large extent, the public at large, I think, goes along with that because they're helping to maintain this bubble of innocence, you know, this sort of bubble of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, mm-hmm. where, you know, people are very aware that outside of the borders of the United States that we're bombing weddings and assassinating people who don't agree, but they just don't think about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to a certain extent, how much you're aware of and how much you don't want to think about things, that translates into a sort of unconscious reflex mechanism. And there are certain things that decent people just don't talk about, and that comes to a certain point of there are certain things that decent people just don't think about.
Right.
And yet, a lot of the writers who have this powerful urge to write, they have this powerful urge to write in a way precisely because they want to talk about things. They want to tell the truth, right, in some way. And maybe in some ways, the urge to write fiction can be an urge to talk about things that you're not allowed to talk about, so you fictionalize them, and that makes it a little bit more permissible. You allegorize them, and then they become even more permissible. You know, in some way, they're disguised or shaded, and maybe the great moments in art are either when a group of people find a way of talking about things that is permitted, or it's permitted for a little while to speak about the truth. But right now in America, you're not allowed to speak about the truth. And so what you have instead are you have these terrible writers like Jonathan Franzen, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all these terrible magazine writers, you know, this kind of magazine style prose, where it's kind of writing where it's like, it's very glib and smug,
yeah.
And, leave it to the experts, trust the experts. And it's kind of like, I don't really know anything, but I know that I know better than those wackos over there.
Right.
And we'll sort of, you and I together will laugh about those wackos and how stupid they are and feel superior. But there's really a lot of fear underneath that mask, you know? This kind of magazine writing. Do you know what I'm talking about? The New York Times, too?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't read any of this stuff, and I've never read Franzen, but I'm pretty sure I know what you're referring to.
It's a certain smugness about the facade.
Mm-hmm.
And the facade being all there is. And the sort of materialism of the sense of that what we can see and touch is all that there is.
Right. Well, there's a thing, the phrase ironic detachment, which I don't know if I coined it or whatever, it doesn't matter, but I used it for The Counselor, the film Counselor, which people hated and critics hated it. And one of the reasons I posited was it didn't have this ironic detachment. It wasn't just kind of have this sort of smug superior attitude that allows us to enjoy the chaos and the violence and the abuse and the deception and the corruption and all the rest of it. Like Breaking Bad, I mean, I enjoyed Breaking Bad, but I saw it as the reason it was so successful had to do with this ironic detachment that you could enter this world of crystal meth dealing and criminals, and it was all fun, and the guy, the you know, sociopath was a hero and you could identify, so it was pure escapism. It gave you that fugue state where you somehow, and it incorporated the, you know, the death of the American dream and the end of the empire and all the rest of it into a narrative which somehow resurrected it in some weird way. Whereas The Counselor just stripped all that down to, for me anyway, to just the bare bones of existential misery and anguish, which is what you're left with when the dream dies. Right?
Yeah, well, I think that's what was so compelling about Breaking Bad was that it did sort of tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
and but it, what you're saying is true too, that at the same time it told it in such a way that it left that whole scenario intact. You know, it doesn't seriously challenge it because of that ironic detachment.
Yeah, and because the medium is the message, right? So the American empire that's being exposed by Breaking Bad as you know, totally corrupt, is also creating this product that proves the opposite. Hey, we're still the best. We can create the best TV shows. And so it gives people a feeling of meaning. I mean, my God, you know, I know that even myself is struggling to get free of pop culture as I am. I still sit down in front of my computer screen and try and watch a good TV show, and I hope it doesn't provide meaning to my life, but it that fugue state is so essential, it seems like, to have a space to escape into. And if people do it undiscerningly, they're not really aware that they're being programmed while they're in that fugue state, then yeah, it does seem like it's just kind of resetting constantly, like, yeah, this is the way America is, but yeah, we're still great, even though if we're criminal sociopaths, it's still, you know, this is heroism now. It's just reframing the heroism. Reminds me of The Searchers, you know, why that movie was so impactful on Generation of Men, because it showed the John Wayne character as a psychopath, but in such a way you could still accept him as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that.
Well, if you go back in the 20th century to you probably saw that BBC documentary, The Century of the Self.
I did, yeah.
It talked about Bernays and yeah, his influence on creating the whole industry of public relations in the United States.
Yeah.
I think what happens is that you start off, I mean, you have sort of a compromised democracy, but there's still some degree of democracy going on. And then you find that if you have an industry in which you have very skilled and well-funded artists working in public relations and crafting these messages that are then distributed through these new mass media that were being developed throughout the 20th century, that the democracy becomes very controllable through that process, and so they can permit anybody to say anything that they like, more or less, because they can sort of just drown it out,
mm-hmm,
with their well-funded, very high production value media.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing in the early aughties, late 90s, early aughties, I collaborated with this composer, Evan Haas, on a trilogy of operas. And I wrote the librettos, and he set them to music. And the first one was about RCA, which was the first, it was basically the first mass media monopoly in the United States. And it was formed from a patent trust. There was Westinghouse, General Electric, and a few other major companies, including Marconi, American Marconi, and they pooled their patents to create the first radio network, which was RCA. And one of those companies being United Fruit, which is interesting.
Right.
Because they were part of the patent trust, because they used the radio communications to control South America, all their banana republics down there.
Right.
And so the bankers and the government put together this patent pool of all the important radio technology and used it to create a radio broadcasting behemoth in the United States. And at the head of it was placed a brigadier general of psychological operations, David Sarnoff. And that became both NBC and ABC.
Hmm.
And the other major American television network, CBS, was run by William Paley, who was another Brigadier General of Psychological Operations. And so the idea that there's freedom of speech in the United States is very interesting. And people would point to the show like Breaking Bad of, oh, they can, you know, these companies, the production companies can put out whatever content they want and the audience decides. But it's not true at all, of course. It's very centralized, and these messages that are constructed and put out with great care to, among other things, foster the idea that there is freedom in the United States, but also to manage a completely controlled consensus reality.
Cold fire will cough out the leather and really feather is not for. Please good, and damn it, not plus more sit and win.
Yeah, I was reading a Bernays quote recently, and I don't know if I should pull it up or not, but it was, what it was implying was a much subtler level of control, and an invisible level of control to the ones that we expect, even if we, or the ones that we acknowledge, even if we acknowledge propaganda and, you know, creation of memes and stuff. This was even subtler than that, in terms of kind of framing the context, or creating the context in which we're thinking about ourselves at all. So I think, I mean, as a metaphor, but maybe even literally as well, if you think about language, how language is created, I mean, our assumption is that we created ourselves as a way to express what's true, but if that's not actually accurate, and if language in some way is imposed on us, say, let's just say hypothetically, if language could be controlled by a ruling class in terms of, you know, what words and what vocabulary and what grammar we end up adopting, then we would only be able to express whatever was represented by that language. If we become language thinkers, you know, internal dialogue, if we're run on the program of language internally as well, we would only be able to think about things that were represented by the language. So if you create the language, then you basically define the reality, both inner and outer, I think.
Yeah, that's like newspeak, right?
Yeah.
And I did some reading about Henry Luce, who created Time magazine and Life magazine.
Yeah.
And he was definitely a OSS, CIA asset. And when Time magazine first came out, this was, of course, long before the CIA even existed, but the CIA is a creation of Wall Street banks, and these existed a long time before the CIA did. And when his magazine first came out, it was a sort of way of talking that he introduced in that magazine, which is now you find it everywhere. It's a way of slanting, you know, so that there's just this really inherent slant to the language. Mm. It's very quick and snappy. And they called it time speak.
Right.
I think there's one quote where they said that the degree to which a person believes what they read in Time magazine is inversely proportional to their familiarity with the topic.
Okay.
So that basically... And I think that that's true, is that it's basically all slant. And if you read any of the popular magazines or newspapers, in the United States, you'll still see that kind of where even, you know, I mean, just the way that they'll talk about the government of the UK, but the regime in Syria, you know, how they use words in that way,
right.
where people just find it, in the United States, they find it compulsory to talk about resistance fighters or jihadis, you know, or terrorists, you know, on this kind of spectrum of how much we like or don't like these people, right. when they're exactly the same sorts of people. They're mercenaries hired by the, you know, someone or other. But yeah, it's very, on a deeper level than just the language, there's this sort of philosophical landscape. And you were talking about John Wayne, this sort of psychopathic hero that we have in almost all Hollywood products from John Ford on, is this basically sociopathic loner that's just lifted completely out of existentialism. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest products that they've been pushing on us in the United States since World War II is existentialism in one form or the other. And, you know, this John, so Bruce Willis character, you know, that he always plays is sort of the arch existentialist.
Mm-hmm.
And this is existentialist materialism. And it's a sort of a reaction against Husserl's phenomenology.
What's that?
Edmund Husserl, he was a philosopher. He started off as a mathematician and became a philosopher, and his was basically a very sort of inward-looking metaphysics, where he wanted to ground the entire Western scientific project philosophically. And he did this by starting off with the experience of consciousness itself. He said that this has to be the ground on which we base everything, because it's the only thing we really know.
Mm-hmm.
And everything has to be grounded on that. And it was a really popular philosophy, and people came from all over Europe to study with him. And one particular student came from the Jesuit university and sort of wormed his way really close up to the master, Husserl. And then as soon as the Nazis came to power and Husserl resigned his post and gave his post to the student, who then took over and reversed the terms of phenomenology. Mm-hmm. Completely abandoned Husserl's standpoint, and his name was Heidegger.
Oh.
And Heidegger then gave birth to all the major philosophers of the 20th century through existentialism.
So that's interesting. I mean, I haven't read Heidegger, but I've even quoted him recently. So how did he reverse? If he reversed it, then what became the ground?
The ground became existence rather than consciousness. So in other words, being in the world is how he called it. It was instead of consciousness coming first, the sort of material historical reality came first.
Without consciousness.
Yeah.
Huh.
And consciousness became a totally powerless conditioned reflection of that.
That's Heidegger. That's really surprising. So that's sort of like the mechanistic viewpoint that consciousness is just a byproduct of biology.
Well, he would say a byproduct of history. So it's not quite as mechanistic, but as opposed to what Husserl would have said, which is that that subjectivity is primary.
Right.
You know, whereas that, and he could, you know, he wasn't going to start off where Husserl was with all of Husserl's disciples in the field of phenomenology around him and immediately turn back to kind of hard, cold, materialistic science. He couldn't make that kind of turn. So it's more like an inflection towards the idea of, he says you're thrown into a world that's already there. You know, whereas Husserl wouldn't have assumed that that world was already there.
Right.
You know, and I think with you, you're talking a little bit about like this idea of the world as matrix. You know, I think that is the idea of questioning, is the world already there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or is it a construct that the idea of the matrix that you're talking about is the world already there, or are we somehow being fooled into creating it in this image that is inimical to our interests?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Being tricked into putting our energy into this construct that steals our energy.
Yeah, I'd say it's a fragment at this point. I mean, it's been a while since I thought in terms of the Matrix, although I am kind of going back there in a sense with going into fiction, and this whole thing that we're talking about now relates to the false dichotomy of fiction and non-fiction, because non-fiction is objective reality, that's the world, right? Whereas fiction is subjective, and yet we think of fiction as false, right? But bringing it back to the what you're saying about the Matrix, it seems to me, I mean, the way I'm trying to understand it now, which is more subjectively, the Matrix model is an objective model, it's out there in the world, it's, you know, it's philosophy, all the rest of it, but what is my personal experience is of not being complete, like not being a complete subject, being in conflict with myself, and so there's a psychological model, which is Donald Kalshed. Well, I don't know if it's his model, but he's expressed it the best I've found in A World of Trauma, which is about psychic fragmentation through trauma and how the fragments can become actual autonomous. They can become autonomous. And we can create a world out of these fragments, but we're living through one fragment. And that fragment is kind of siphoning off the life force, and creating a world, a dissociative fantasy world, while the body, in a sense, is being siphoned off, just like in the Matrix. So there's something, I mean, it's not very completely expressed there, but there's something in the Matrix model which does seem to represent an experience that is experiential, that's happening in each of us as a psyche body system. You know, what are we? We're not just a body, we know that, some level, well, some of us do anyway. But the world of the psyche is kind of inaccessible to us. The world of the unconscious, by definition, is inaccessible to us. Which brings me back to writing and what it seems to mean to me, which is that the unconscious won't express itself. We can't go directly to it, and we won't let it express itself consciously, because there's a reason why we've made it unconscious. So it's like, how do we trick ourselves into expressing things in our unconscious that we don't want to know?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. When I was in college, I was compulsively writing fiction,
uh-huh.
and I wrote all these novels. And I just recently went back and read, well, I read one all the way through, and it was amazing because I guess maybe around 4 or 5 years ago, I had all these sort of crazy psychic experiences where I went through all this unconscious content that I hadn't dealt with. And part of it had to do with having finally quit drinking after all these years, you know, and not sort of, you know, that being an alcoholic for many years is a sort of like there's this constant suicidal urge that you're indulging in, you know. as self-annihilation. And so when I quit doing that, all this stuff started coming, bubbling up, and I had to work through it in this way. At the same time, reading a lot about the psychology of ritual trauma, and then reading through a couple of these novels and finding like that I would read them and I'd have to put them down, you know, because it was just this stuff that I had been trying to tell myself through this process of compulsive writing was all in there, but I had written it down and then shut it away, you know, for years and years and years to avoid, as a way of like sort of saying it and processing it, but without actually having to deal with it.
Right.
So, you know, I think maybe that's one reason. And if you notice certain writers who have this sort of compulsive need to rewrite the same novel over and over again, as reading a lot of writers, sometimes you get very close to what their unconscious issues are in a way that they might not even be conscious of.
Sure.
And with my oof, I have all these books dealing with mind control and with technological and other forms, occult mind control going on there that led me back to my upbringing, which was in Texas. In this, we were at this very different high school in Texas. It was right by the Johnson Space Center, where almost, you know, a lot of people were the children of rocket scientists, PhDs, and then there was also a lot of stuff that were like CIA black ops going on under the cover of NASA. And lots of military contractors were there, like, you know, IBM, McDonnell Douglas, Raytheon, that were working on things like multiple reentry missile systems, all kinds of missile technology, things like that, that were connected to manned spaceflight in some way or other.
Wow.
And then so we had all kinds of crazy things going on then there, like, that we sort of took for granted then, but later on, you know, as I'm reading through these novels, seeing all this stuff that is reflected in there as material, like when I was just about to go into the high school, I guess a couple of years before I was in the high school, there was a suicide cult amongst the kids at the high school that got national attention, because I don't know how many kids committed suicide, but I'm sure that the whole suicide cult story was a cover-up of what was actually going on there.
Right.
Also in our neighborhood was, you may have heard of Andrea Yates, the woman who like drowned her five children, and her husband worked for NASA. There was a house nearby where a guy had been axe murdered by the teenage boys that he hired to sexually service him there, or imprisoned to sexually service him there, you know?
Right.
And all this kind of stuff was going on around NASA, you know?
Wow.
And then there was a woman, her name, Judith Peterson, who was a psychologist who started deprogramming satanic cult members out there in Houston. And she was a victim of like a multi-million dollar lawsuit that was dismissed, but she lost her job and had to go practice somewhere else. I mean, there was all this kind of stuff going on down there. And it was all... like that was part of the reason why I had this like compulsive run of writing these novels, and couldn't stop writing, you know.
Did your family have any connections to the government?
Not overtly. And but I think the way that things go in Houston is, first of all, I think if you look at like the Bush family and the way that say, you know, our Busto, George Herbert Walker Bush formed this company, our Busto, which was a sort of fringe company off to the edge of the oil industry, like a sort of, I think basically that the oil industry is very, very deeply connected to the deep state.
Mm-hmm.
The oil companies are also really deeply connected to European hereditary elites. Like a lot of these, there were a lot of Prussian and German immigrants to Germany, including like Junker nobles throughout the late 19th century. And a lot of these big families that are deeply involved in the bigger oil companies in Houston are European nobility families. And I think that they're sort of constitutive of the deep state in a way that that might precede the CIA and these governmental agencies. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Like, almost like the CIA and the government agencies are agents that work on behalf of these deeper structures.
It does seem like that, because we're getting dangerously close to David Icke in Waters, and I was going to bring up Icke previously when we were talking about, can't remember what we were talking about, but as an example of how the medium is as or more important than the message. So we were talking about what we can talk about in our society, and how, in a sense, there are people out there talking about this stuff, but it's very important that the people who are talking about it are the right people, so to speak. So, I mean, when you're telling your background, it's reminding me, point for point, with Whitley Strieber. I wrote a whole book about Whitley Strieber, you know, the alien abductee. And he also grew up in Texas, and he also grew up near a military base. And he's,
oh, I didn't know he was from Texas.
Yeah, San Antonio.
I'd known that and suppressed it or something.
But anyway, look, I mean, that's a whole thing. So, long story short, that he it seemed to me that he was socially engineered as a spokesperson for these truths. Mm-hmm. A messenger who would distort the message simply by being the medium that he was. Like, it's just the way in which the information is contextualized somehow neutralizes it, I think, or even makes it, even contaminates it in some way. That was my experience with Strieber. But anyway, that was a side point, really, about what you were getting into. That I do. Yeah, I mean, my background is has nothing to do with NASA or military bases, but has to do with Fabianism, the Fabian Society, who created the Labour Party, and
George Bernard Shaw and
Webb, yeah, and they were eugenicists, and they were into social engineering. H.G. Wells was one of them, although he found them too Machiavellian for his taste, and H.G. Wells was pretty Machiavellian in my opinion. And they were into sexual experimentation, sexual psychology, studying children, child sexuality. And so there's a kind of line of, one can trace the progression from the Fabians to the Labour Party to the paedophile information exchange, which notoriously came about in the 70s, and thence to all of these different, you know, rings of abuse, and of course MKUltra in the US using sex abuse of children as a way to engineer public figures, it would seem, and so on. So that nexus is also, it does seem to be global. And it does seem to intersect with my family in terms of around Fabianism. And my family was my grandfather was supposedly working class, and that he got into Oxford, and then he went to Nigeria as an assistant to the district officer, i.e. as a government official in Nigeria. And from there he founded the Fabian Society in his province in Hull, and then he co-founded the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. He was friends with Bertrand Russell, and he was on various other committees, and then he befriended these different prisoners, murderers and rapists, and so there's plenty, you know. Once I started looking at it with the eye that I've developed by studying and researching Whitley Strieber and other, you know, areas of intrigue in the world, once I brought that lens to my own past, suddenly the whole thing was transformed, and I couldn't help but suspect any number of different elements, but also what you're saying, that, you know, maybe my family is kind of aristocracy that fell on hard times and then was lifted up again, and so there does seem to be something like that. And Jimmy Savile also, they haven't tied him to the Savile family, but there is a Savile family that was aristocracy, and he used to call his mother the Duchess. So there's an indication there that maybe that Jimmy Savile was also part of these bloodlines. And I don't doubt it. But as I say, it seems to have been kind of hijacked, the narrative or that understanding or that framing seems to have been hijacked by the sort of low conspiracy lore. And I think this is happening all the time. Like, you and I are talking about this stuff as artists, creative people who are not, well, we're fringe in our own way, but I don't belong to the Alex Jones sort of, or the David Icke audience cult at all. I don't have any time for it. And it's pretty rare that a conversation like this happens, I think, about these things that isn't already hooked into what I call the second matrix, where it's all the dots have been joined, and yeah, it's the Illuminati and it's the royal bloodlines and so on and so forth, right? So there's no sense of discovery there. It's already been, it's like spiked ground. It's like the truth has been, because it was coming out anyway, it's been rearranged in such a way that when it comes out, A, most people don't believe it, and B, it's not really accurate anyway, because you just need a few elements that aren't emphasized correctly, or, you know.
Well, I think one problem with that kind of rhetoric is that it turns it all into a us versus them sort of thing, when I think it's all us. It's we're a pretty small gene pool, and we've all been living together for thousands of years. And so it's not really like there's this profound separation between them and us.
Right. Well, I mean, this is what you and I are discovering, maybe. I mean, you didn't really get there when I asked about your family, but it seemed like you had some feeling that there was an overlap there between your own background and the environment, the world that you were, you know, spewed into, as it were.
I feel like, obviously that there's a difference in orientation. Like, you had this grandfather who, came from difficult circumstances, and he probably would have done a lot to get out of them, you know, and raise himself by whatever means necessary, mm-hmm. or at least by some means necessary. Probably it all seemed reasonable to him, you know, and you, on the other hand, give up your inheritance, mm-hmm. you know, because of moral issues. I imagine.
Well, actually, it wasn't. It was for personal issues. I was just fucked, and I just had to, bail out of my life. So, yeah, it wasn't a moral issue. And later, I began to see, oh, that's why I had to get rid of the money.
But, you felt like there was some sort of dirtiness to it, or something. Like you had to purify yourself.
Initially, it was an externalization of an internal need. You know, I've got to go back to zero. I've got my life, you know, I followed the wrong path, so I need to reset. So let's just get rid of everything. and stripped myself down to nothing. So that was, there was a spiritual impetus behind that, and even a sort of a personal one in terms of, yeah, I want to be able to be a self-made man. So there were various different elements, but there was never at that time a feeling, oh, this money is dirty. I hadn't even become conscious of that possibility, because I thought all money was dirty, which I suppose I still do in a sense. But no, I mean, now I see that the money came with a, I mean, it's like blood money. It came with a, with hooks in it. And it's, you know, in a very simple sense, like our father wasn't able to be a father to us. He didn't give us any love or validation or support. So he gave us money. So we were bought off. You know, my father bought me off with this money, just as he was bought off in a sense. And then later I discovered at least that my grandfather was involved with stuff that made a fallacy of everything that he claimed to believe, like his liberal values and all the rest of it, and being a socialist. And I think my father, he believed that his father's lie and joined the family business. And then at a certain point he discovered, maybe just incrementally, that he had signed up for something that was very opposite of what had appeared. And I think that probably all but destroyed him at some level. I mean, not to oversimplify it, but I think something of that nature happened, because he always hated being a businessman, and I think he hated himself, and he definitely hated his father. So yeah, there's a whole knot there that has never been untangled, and I think it relates to this generational abuse of power that conceals itself behind a false value set. That was the first part of my conversation with Gary Hight. And you can find out more about Gary by following the links in the show notes at horticulture.com/liminalist. And this has been Gary Hight's music that you've been listening to on this current podcast. The second part of this conversation will be up, as per usual, next Wednesday. That's the 28th of October, 2015. I was supposed to talk to James Hollis today for a Halloween podcast, but unfortunately I messed up with the time difference. Got it. I got a little confused about that. So I don't have anyone lined up for Halloween. Not yet, anyway. That's about all, I guess. I'm dismantling the Patreon account. I'm going to look into how to subscribe through PayPal if people want to make regular donations. Otherwise, you can just make one-off donations as per usual at the PayPal button at the website or at my blog. That's it. That's all I got. Till next time, he said to his microphone, well, feeling it was time for another bowel movement. As usual, not really. Doesn't happen all the time. Just 2-3 times a day. TMI from the Liminalist.